Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Friday, January the 27th. And today we're going to catch up with our good friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie editor. We're going to talk about a couple of big topics. One is the Democrat Party and what I would describe as the collapsing Democrat Party. I'm not suggesting that they are dead. You never want to do that with a political party, certainly not the oldest political party in the United States. But it's clearly a party going through a serious identity crisis, and I think they're doing a lot of crazy things that maybe this is what you would expect after a disappointment. But nevertheless, I think that party better come together very soon, or they will find themselves in a minority status for a while. And we're also going to talk about President Trump week number one. I have never seen anything like this before. I'm not saying it's all good or that we will still be talking about it a year from now, but he's clearly, I think, doing what the base or the people who voted for him wanted him to do. And he's out there, and I think he's winning a lot of hearts and minds, as they like to say. So far, the most amazing first week of a president that I've ever seen. I just don't remember a president being this active and doing this and that. Maybe historically we would have to go back to FDR in 1933, maybe. I don't know if that's even comparable. Before we get to our friend Barry Castleman, and by the way, we have a link to his website on the show information. Before we get to our friend Barry, I do want to point out that we also have a link on the show information to my friends at Residential Electricity Rates. If you're shopping for residential electricity, just click on that link. You put in your zip code, and maybe we can save you some money. And that would be wonderful if we can do that. Let me say hello to our good friend Barry Castleman up in Minnesota. How are you, Barry?
I'm good. It's good to talk to you.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and I wanted to tell the listeners, I mentioned that we have a link to your website, and I want to specifically direct our listeners to a column that you just wrote or a post that you just wrote about the Congress of Vienna, where once again you give your subscribers your wonderful knowledge of history, and you go back to that one event in the early 19th century, the Congress of Vienna. So take a minute, Barry, and just talk a little bit about that column. I know it's not what we're going to talk about tonight, but I just want the listeners to hear from you about that column, because I loved it. I thought it was one of your best ones. And please just take a few minutes and talk about that column, please.
Well, thank you. Actually, I think it's one of my favorite columns because, as you know, I love to talk about history, but always about history as it potentially relates to the present and the future. Now, the Congress of Vienna in 1815 was called by the various powers of Europe as Napoleon had been deposed, although he did make a 100-day return that was finally was defeated and sent to St. Helena in permanent exile, where he died. But at the end of the Congress, but what the Congress did, led by the Prince Metternich of Austria-Hungary, was to create what is called in history the chandelier balance of power. And what they did is they redrew the borders of Europe in such a manner that the major powers, which were then in those days Prussia, France, of course, had been defeated, but Prussia, Great Britain, Austria-Hungary, and Russia, were not in a position to intrude on each other. That there was a kind of a balance. So every country would sort of keep to its own interests and its own borders. And interestingly enough, although there were a little bit of short-term revolutions and small wars in Europe in the interim, for 100 years, until the assassination in Sarajevo in 1914, that balance held. And then it collapsed. And then we had what I call the second Hundred Years' War, which is World War I, which I have written about, has never really ended. It led to World War II. It led to the Cold War. It led to Vietnam. It led to the Middle East. All of those things are directly related to the First World War and its Treaty of Versailles that was signed in 1921. Now we're in a third. We're in a third century. And I suggest that although may not even be his intention, President Trump's reset of the international order, which is what is beginning, seems to be taking place, could lead to another version of the Congress of Vienna and a new balance, because I said we have new world powers emerging. Not only is the United States in place and Russia and Europe in place, but we now have two giant populous nations emerging as economic powers, China and India, each with about 1.3 billion persons each, which dwarfs all the other countries in the world, all the other major powers. So that is the point of my piece. I don't get into any specifics. I don't make any real predictions other than to say the opportunity exists for a new Congress of Vienna that might lead to a more peaceful world, a world that would be unlike the past 100 years of war, Holocaust, and violence.
Right. And I think for those who are, you know, I think for people like me who are always looking for that, you know, that point that you make, you know, that extra point that you make in your columns, or who read your website to pick up that extra information that you don't get from the regular websites or whatever. That's how I read it. I mean, I read it as you were talking about something that we could be talking about a great deal a year from now. I think this reset that you're talking about is occurring, of course, because of President Trump. He had a press conference today with the Prime Minister of the UK, and you could sort of begin to feel that reset taking place. And I think there's also a lot of other things happening in Europe internally. That are making people very worried in Europe, the refugees, the economic crisis, you know, the collapse of birth rates and all of that. I mean, there's a lot of stuff happening in Europe that are also driving or making things potentially very chaotic in Europe. So, again, I just wanted you to mention it, Barry, because I thought it was one of your finest pieces. And I know that over the last couple of years, you've always been ahead of the curve, if I could put it that way. I mean, you were the first one to talk about, you know, the revolt of the masses, and you were the one who wrote about the media a year ago, and both of those posts that you wrote were very much forward-thinking and things that we began to see. One of them was even quoted by Newt Gingrich on Fox News. So that's why I wanted you to bring it up. It's not completely what we're going to talk about tonight, but I just wanted the listeners to at least click on your website and catch this website, because this is, I mean, this post, because I think this is one of those that they ought to save and maybe read in about 6 months or 9 months, when I think it may even be more relevant there.
Well, we'll wait and see, but thanks for mentioning it.
All right. Well, let's get into, we've got a couple of interesting topics today. We have the Democrat Party, the state of the Democrat Party, and the first week of President Trump. I have never seen a president do this in his first week. It's been hard to watch. If he keeps this up, he's going to wear out his staff because he's just been one incredible machine, just running like crazy. But let's talk about the Democrats, because I think, look, I'm a Republican. Everybody knows that, but I've always felt that the country, a good democracy, needs two strong parties to check each other, hopefully two centrist kind of parties, one maybe leaning to the left, one to the right, but basically two strong parties. And I fear, unless the Democrats get their act together, that we could be a one-party country here pretty soon. It could be for a while until the Democrats get their party together, their act together, Barry.
Well, they don't think so. And that's why I think they're living, I think, in the past, as are some Republicans. As I wrote in an earlier post this week, there are new rules. And the new rules are not, you know, aren't defined just by Donald Trump. There are just new rules out there, new political rules. Trump was the one who understood the new world, the new rules, and exploited them, and got and made a tremendous historical upset as a result. But the fact remains, it's a whole new ball game, and all the stereotypes and lessons of the past that were tried, that pundits often apply and academics often apply, and even political operatives try and apply, saying, "Well, this is the way it's been doing. It's been going for this, so many cycles, for decades and decades." But one of the things about history is that periodically the rules get changed because the country evolves politically, economically, socially, and that's what's happened. And those who, it was perfectly understandable. People didn't agree necessarily with Donald Trump, who were both on the right and the left, conservatives and liberals. People found him distasteful as a what he said, and of course didn't necessarily agree with his ideas. But the country apparently did, because the election, which was a electoral college election, not a popular vote election, chose Donald Trump to be the president. And then since that time, most come around to understand that even though they may not still agree completely with Donald Trump or even like the way he speaks, that he is the president, and he is the president who's going to advance most of their conservative ideas. And there are still a few holdouts, especially in the punditry, and unfortunately it includes people that we all liked in the past, such as George Will and Charles Krauthammer and Bill Kristol. They still seem to be unable to make the transition. But the Democrats, almost as a party, as a whole party, with some exceptions, seem to be thinking, well, we're going to delegitimize the presidency, and we're going to try and make fun of Donald Trump and make the most of his statements, not realizing that they're playing his game. One of the most notable examples of this is the most recent, is his claim that millions of of illegal aliens voted in the election, and presumably he is suggesting voted against him, voted for Hillary Clinton. Now, the fact of that, of course, the media immediately leaped on this. Well, there's no proof of this, and there's no evidence of it. And of course, they became preoccupied with this in the first week of his presidency, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But there were a lot of very important things he did in the first week. But the discussion in the media and among Democrats was all about this claim of Trump, which may or may not be true, most likely is not as true, not true in terms of millions. But, I don't think there's much question that some people voted illegally, but how many is completely unknown at this point. But that is really not a very substantive. The election is over. We have a new president. And even though the media is making a big deal about Trump being thin-skinned and talking about it, what he has successfully done by this is deflect attention away from the controversial things he's doing, such as withdrawing support from the United Nations other things, changing border control, changing the rules of the national government. So it really I think supports your idea that this is a, I don't know if the word is a collapse, it might be that, but it's certainly an inability of the Democratic Party leadership and many Democrats to engage in the new situation. Therefore, basically allowing Trump to gain, and I think there's no question that now I don't know if Rasmussen is correct that his support is at 59%, which was reported mm-hmm. today. I don't know if it's quite that high, but it's certainly a lot higher than it was a week ago, because to a certain extent, Mr. Trump is doing things which is being supported by a lot of Americans, not everybody, but probably a majority of Americans. And instead of providing a thoughtful criticism of what he's doing, the Democrats and the Democratic leaders are, and the media especially, is focused on his tweets, which are about things that aren't relevant. And this is what he's been doing for over a year. This is how he won.
Right.
He did all those tweets, and he spoke directly to his people, who never took him literally, but mm-hmm. took him for his ideas. The Democrats insist on taking him absolutely literally and becoming obsessed with these notions, which are not substantive, and not dealing with the issues which are substantive, which he is doing, as you point out, in very rapid order. It is already in only 1 week.
Right. Let me bring up a couple of points about the Democrats, because I think and then we'll take a break and then we'll come back and talk about this amazing first week of President Trump. But I think the Democrats are making a huge mistake in not understanding correctly what happened the first Tuesday of November. They look at the presidential vote, and indeed – Mrs. Clinton got 2 million, 3 million, whatever the number is, more than President, Mr. Trump. Of course, all of it came from California, but, you know, it is what it is. She got more votes. But what they're not seeing is where the damage actually took place. I mean, the really bad night for the Democrats was not that Mrs. Clinton lost. It was really what happened beneath Mrs. Clinton, all the senators, all the House members, all the state legislatures. And that's where I think their problem is. They keep thinking, well, if we run again a campaign, but maybe run the same campaign but just have a better candidate, we'll get those, you know, that popular vote again. But that's not where their problem is. The problem, Barry, is down at the state legislatures. If I could use a baseball analogy, this is a major league team that does not have much of a farm system. In fact, they don't have any. And as you know, in Major League Baseball, you rebuild from your farm system, and they don't have anybody, Barry.
Well, I think you're making a valid point, and I think that the fact that they're not, I mean, they never accepted election night from the beginning. First, they wanted a recount, even though there was no real evidence that there had been the vote count wasn't accurate. Then they wanted to persuade the Electoral College members from voting for whom they were obligated to vote for. And then even at the very end, on the day that the election became official, they tried to stop it with Vice President Biden in charge. And he basically said, it's over, folks. So there was that unreality. And then once they realized that he was going to be inaugurated, and he was, they decided, well, we're going to delegitimize him. We're going to constantly attack him. We're going to say nothing. We're going to oppose every one of his appointees. We're going to do everything we can to sabotage his presidency. But that's not what happens when we have an election. In 2008, right after Election Day 2009, there were disappointed Republicans, and even some people who brought up what I never took seriously, the so-called birthing argument. There were people who tried to to who were, shall we say, bad sports about the election. But the truth of the matter was that Barack Obama won that election fair and square. And he won re-election in 2012 fair and square against a very serious opponent. And that was what the country accepted. And when Barack Obama was elected in 2008, in 2009, in January, when he took office, his cabinet members were approved. Not everybody, the Republicans didn't particularly like them. And when he nominated two very liberal people to be on the Supreme Court, the Republicans certainly didn't like it, and some of them did vote against it. But, of course, they were passed because they were respectable people, even if
right.
we didn't share their philosophy. And so mm-hmm. were his appointees to the cabinet. A president gets, first of all, has the right to appoint the people who work for it. Now, if the choice is really egregiously bad, if there's some really real problem, yes, that's why you have the confirm and consent of the Senate. And in terms of the Supreme Court, the president is supposed to appoint, and usually in the early part of an administration, you get to appoint the person you want. Again, provided you appoint somebody who is worthy of the job. I always agree.
Right.
There's a reason why the Constitution has the confirm and consent clause.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is a check against a bad appointment. The president's
but that's not what we're watching. Yeah, I got to take a break.
But that's not what we're watching.
You know, what we're watching from Democrats is, like you said before, they're just opposed to anything he does, and especially with the cabinet. And then we'll take a break and come back. But with the cabinet, I've always felt that the president's people should be confirmed as soon as possible so that they're ready when he becomes president. And if there's a problem, like you say, if there's a very bad nominee, well, you can deal with that. But that's not the case here. I mean, there's some really good nominees, at least in my opinion, and I think the Democrats are making a big mistake. We're going to take a little break. We'll hear from one of our sponsors, and then we'll come back with our friend Barry Castleman, Prairie Editor, right after this. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, checking with our good friend Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. We're looking at what's going on. We were just talking about the Democrats. Now we want to move on to President Trump in week number one. Barry, anything else that you wanted, because I know I had to take a break. I didn't mean to cut you off. But any point there that you didn't get a chance to make regarding the Democrats? I was saying that I think what they're doing to the cabinet is very unfortunate because they're just they're running against the appointments just for the sake of being of opposing them, not necessarily because the people are bad quality there.
Right. And the caution here is the next election, the midterm election, is in 2018. That's less than 2 years away. And normally it's a difficult election for a first-term president, as it was for Barack Obama and was for Bill Clinton before him, and even for Ronald Reagan in his first term, because it's always difficult. But the Republicans have a very interesting advantage going in 2018. In the exact opposite situation from 2016, there are 25 Democratic incumbent senators up for re-election and only 8 Republicans. And of those 8 Republicans, 6 are almost for sure to win, and the other 2 are probably going to win. And of the 25 Democrats, at least 10 to 12 are potentially vulnerable. And that doesn't count, of course, retirements on either side. So there's a very big risk that the Democrats could lose ground. You know, the Senate is now 52 to 48 in favor of the Republicans. It was 54-46, but the Republicans gained the advantage of having the president of the Senate, who's the vice president, being a Republican, who breaks all the tie votes. But the Republicans have a narrow majority, but they could go to close to or above 60 votes, which would make it veto-proof, make the presidential actions veto-proof in the Senate. And they take that risk, and you have vulnerable senators, particularly, I think I could mention two, Joe Manchin in West Virginia and Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, two very Republicans, now red states. And although they are both moderates, and they are both, I respect and admire them both, they're potentially in trouble if they would join in a mindless effort to block everything that President Trump tries to do. Now, that doesn't mean that the Democrats don't have an opposition and don't disagree, but there are certain things, such as cabinet appointments, that you don't over-politicize. And what's happening here in the first days following the inauguration of President Trump, and has existed in the first 2 months since the election, is what I feel, and I think you feel, is an overreaction by Democrats in trying to deny reality and deny the fact that, as I wrote, there are new rules out there. And it's, when the rules are changed, you have only one choice. You either adapt to the new rules and play by them, or you fall by the wayside. That doesn't mean to say the new rules are not partisan. The new rules are simply the way things are, and the Democratic Party is an opposition party now, and it should be, but it needs to do it with care, so that the voters don't get so turned off that they turn, as you have suggested, even more to the Republican Party, and making the Republican Party an overwhelmingly powerful party, something that's probably not good for the whole country.
No, I agree with you. As a Republican, I agree with you. I mean, I'm not even sure we should have a party with 60 votes, because that, I think, works against the country. I think getting to 60 votes with people from the other side is a better deal for the country. I mean, when you have a veto-proof legislature, I'm not sure that's good, because then they don't have to work together. But I really believe with the cabinet. And I have felt this way. I felt this way when President Obama won. I felt this way when President Clinton won, that you give them their cabinet, because for the most part, this is going to be their team. It's like a major league manager. You know, he has to have his own third base coach. You know, you're not going to deny him a third base coach or his coaching staff. And then down the road, you know, you have opportunities to play politics later on. For example, your senator from Minnesota, not the gentleman, not the lady, I can't think of his name right now, was saying that not a single Al Franken, Senator Franken, was saying that not a single Democrat was going to vote for the Secretary of Education, Mrs.
DeVos,
I think it is. DeVos,
yes.
Yeah. That not a single Democrat was going to vote for this lady. I don't know if that's true. But that's the kind of nonsense that I think hurts the country. I mean, these Democrats may disagree with her on school choice or whatever, but again, this is Mr. Trump's team. He gets to pick a Secretary of Education. That's why we had an election. But let's move on to, before we run out of time, let's move on to week number one, because I'm really anxious to hear what you say about this. This is the most interesting week I've ever seen. I mean, just a week ago, Barry, this gentleman became president of the United States. We were watching him dance on television. He was dancing like presidents do on their first day. A week later, he's signed a bunch of executive orders. He has set the tone, as you were talking before, reset our relations with other countries. He's talking about a lot of things. Now, I personally disagree with what is going on with Mexico. I don't mind the fence. I think building the fence is probably good for both countries. But I don't think it was a good idea to push the president of Mexico the way he did, because then the president of Mexico had no choice but to cancel the meeting. I thought that was overdoing it by President Trump, but, you know, that is his style. I get it. But overall, I think it's been a pretty good week. So let me get your reaction to week one, and if there's any historical comparison, I couldn't think of any, Barry.
Well, there's no question there is. You as you alluded to, I mean, the first days of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency were immense. I mean, he closed the banks. He spoke to the country. He reassured the country. It was a much more emotional period than of course we are facing today. I'm not saying the problems were any greater ultimately, but there was much more a sense of immediate crisis, and the banks were, in fact, before he declared the bank holiday, banks were going up, belly up, and the whole banking system was almost ready to collapse. And there was talk even of physical revolution in Washington. Coxey's army, a bunch of World War I veterans, were camped out in the public spaces of Washington, and then General MacArthur and Colonel Dwight David Eisenhower on horseback were called in to keep them under control, because they were threatening to maybe topple the government. I mean, we have to understand that was a different world. That was the Depression was going on. The stock market had collapsed. So there is a precedent for very busy activity. But I will agree with you, since that time, new presidents coming in have not seemed to have done so much. But as I suggested, you know, it's a new world. And in fact, although Ronald Reagan didn't make as dramatic changes so rapidly as perhaps Mr. Trump is doing, nevertheless, the change from Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan was, in the intermediate term, was almost as dramatic, because there were really two different philosophies of government. And what we have here is two different philosophies of government. The philosophy of government that President Obama led is basically coming to a somewhat abrupt end here with the policies of President Trump, although not all of them. We have yet to see many issues not addressed, especially since most of the cabinet are not in place and not operating. But already we see as dramatic a case that occurred today. The Prime Minister of England, Theresa May, no less, has basically come over here and basically said, "I get it." She's not said I agree everything with the president. She said basically, "But I understand that is a new international order, and I am willing to join with President Trump," she said, in helping to create it, but not telling. She made it very clear we can't basically run the world, but we can nevertheless play a huge part in the reordering of the world, a world order. So she's showing a lot, I think, not only of courage, but of prescience in getting the fact that there is a change has taken place. And she understands that our historical relationship between England, Great Britain, the United Kingdom, and the U.S. is actually a very strong one, although it was weakened in the last 8 years under President Obama. She understands that President Trump wants to strengthen it, and she's basically holding out her hand, saying, let's be partners. And the same thing is happening in the Middle East with Israel.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting with the Prime Minister of the U.K., because I feel, and you know, we'll see in the next few months, that the U.K. or this prime minister is beginning to feel a little isolated from Europe, not just because of Brexit, but because of what is going on in Europe, that they're beginning to feel a little isolated. So reconnecting with the United States is a natural step, I think, in this crazy world. But let me get back to week one of Trump for a second, because the other thing I think he's done in a masterful way is, for example, when he does these executive orders. In the past, a president would sign an executive order, and that's it. He would sign the executive order, but no, not Mr. Trump. He goes out and, you know, he signs them in front of the media. He even reads and explains what he's signing. I mean, every one of these signings has been, the newscast will break into the news to bring you the signing. So the American people, the ones who are watching their president sign these executive orders. He explains what he's doing. I mean, the man is a genius when it comes to communicating with the public, Barry.
Well, he certainly seems to be the master of communications in a world that has, in which the communications environment has dramatically changed in only a decade. And he has used unorthodox methods to go around a hostile mainstream media, which not only doubles down but triples down on its hostility to President Trump, a big mistake, because as you know, I wrote a piece saying and I wrote it in the American Thinker, that the media, the news media, now not the general media, but the news media, the front page media, as we knew it, is coming to an end, and it's being hastened in that coming to an end by its own actions, by its own inability to give Donald Trump a fair shake. They don't have to agree with him. They don't have to praise him. But they, in terms of, and the op-ed and editorial writers can say whatever they please, but the fact is that the news reporting of what President Trump is doing in the first week, as you point out, deserves a fair reporting, and by not doing it, what they're doing is they're turning people away, and we're seeing it already in the ratings. CNN is going through the basement. The worst examples the worst abusers of the which is a continuation of what I called earlier, as you know, the media coup d'etat against Mr. Trump. The worst abusers of this are finding that people, other than the people who completely agree with them, are turning away from them. And therefore,
that's right,
they're looking for new media outlets. And the old mainstream media is getting smaller and smaller. We see I just saw the thing, Fox News continues to be larger than all the rest of them put together on cable.
That's right. Rudge, it's remarkable.
Drudge is still the largest. And Rush Limbaugh. Now, that doesn't mean we agree with Drudge, Rush Limbaugh.
Right.
But the point is that people are turning more and more to them and away from the traditional mainstream media. And in the end, since that mainstream media depends on advertising, on its economic survival, I think that they're going to have to face the fact that they're making a big mistake.
I think you're right. I think you're right about that. And if you look at the ratings, no question. I mean, Fox News has always done well, but if you look at CNN and some of the ratings, they're even dropping below MSNBC, which is, I'm sure for them, that's a pretty bad deal. But I would argue that the media, what the media has to do is just give the guy a chance. And part of the problem is, and I can only speak for myself here, I think many of us who saw the way the media treated President Obama, I thought they were very easy on President Obama, really, particularly not so much in the beginning. I can understand the honeymoon. But my goodness, I mean, in the second term where you had Obamacare falling apart, you had Benghazi, you had the IRS scandal, you had the problems in Syria, you had the problems in Iraq. I never felt that President Obama was given, frankly, very tough treatment by the press. And so when you compare that to what is happening to President Trump, I think that upsets, I'll speak for myself, that upsets a lot of people like me who wish that the media had been this this tough with President Obama. We're going to have to wrap it up, Barry. As always, very grateful to you. Again, congratulations on the wonderful stuff that you write as a subscriber to your website. I get this stuff almost on a daily basis, and it is absolutely wonderful. So congratulations for the great work that you do. It's just absolutely great, and I encourage everybody to become a subscriber to your website, because they're going to get perspectives that they just don't get anywhere else, Barry.
Well, thank you for your kind words, and I always enjoy being on your show. It's always a great conversation. We both of us have editorial points of view, and people can take us with a grain of salt. But the fact is it's always great to have programs like this, which enable alternative points of view. I mean, frankly, there's not a lot of that going on right now, and you're one of the best sources of that I know. So thank you for including me.
Well, thank you so much. Pretty soon we'll have a chance to talk a little baseball in a couple of months, and that's always that's also a fun part of talking to you when we get into the baseball season. Have a wonderful evening. And we will talk to you later, Barry. Thank you very much. Barry Castleman, the Prairie Editor. Like I said, we have a link on the show information to his website. He's just absolutely wonderful. I find his material to be just absolutely great. And I enjoy it so much when I get the messages from his website that there's a new post and so on. It's just, I read them a lot. I share them with my friends. It's just absolutely great. Well, this is Silvio Canto in Dallas. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you later.